And welcome back. And how many functions do we have with our brain? The expert, Neil Slade, joins us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Neil Slade teaches people how to easily release their brain's pre-existing neurocircuits for very high increases in creativity, intelligence, as well as numerous paranormal abilities. His web is a staple of the internet and remains one of the most popular online resources for information about the human brain, how it works. He has supplied us some incredible visuals today that are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Neil, welcome back.
Hi, George. It's been a little while, but great to talk to you again.
Always good talking to you, my friend. What's new with you?
Well, quite a bit, actually. We've had some interesting events around here that I'd probably like to share with you. And you mentioned the photos online. Maybe we could start there.
Sure. And here for you, you're still in Colorado?
Definitely. I've been here for most of my life.
Good for you. Good for you. Any conferences coming up for you?
No conferences. Just, continuing to teach music and teach brain and, live a wonderful life here in Denver where the weather is beautiful most of the time and enjoy the mountains. And that's part of the story I wanted to share with you tonight.
Okay, great. And, of course, how did you get started in studying the brain, Neil?
Well, I was watching public television one night, and there was an interesting gentleman who had a brain laboratory that was located in the wilderness, and his name was T.D. Lingo. And he was a former folk singer and television star, but his love had always been science and brain science. And he started a place called the Dormant Brain Research and Development Laboratory. And he was described, there was a documentary on public television that I just tuned into late one night, and I decided to write him because it looked like the experience at his wilderness brain lab was very interesting. And I went up and met him and then ended up spending the next 11 years as his primary assistant running the brain lab and educational programs out of the brain lab.
I remember years ago, Neil, when we were talking about your work, the tickle your amygdala.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Of course.
Explain what the amygdala is again to people.
Well, the amygdala is, tickling your amygdala is a phrase that simply means to consciously stimulate the pleasure circuits in your brain directly and indirectly. And there are several key areas in the brain involved in rewarding certain kinds of thinking and behavior, rewarding primarily advanced and cooperative behavior. And one of those little areas is called the amygdala. And the amygdala is a little button-shaped portion of the brain, and it's located about an inch inside each of your temples. And you have two amygdala. Excuse me. Each one is located about an inch inside each temple. And so when you tickle your amygdala, you turn on more of your frontal lobes, the most advanced part of your brain. Tickling your amygdala and turning on the most advanced part of your brain goes in tandem. And the way that you get pleasure is the brain responds automatically with positive emotional reward and that life feels good feeling. And so the amygdala is kind of this built-in system by where your brain rewards advanced thinking that helps you to survive. It rewards you for efficient thinking and the type of thinking that will help you survive in the long run and also help society at large. So that's what tickling the amygdala is all about.
Doesn't the amygdala also allow for ESP and other paranormal events?
Well, the amygdala is really part of what's called the limbic system, which is kind of a midsection of your brain, what is commonly called the mammal brain. Dr. Paul MacLean back in the 60s divided the brain up into three sections. He called the innermost part the reptile brain, which computes very basic survival. And then there's this middle layer called the limbic system, of which the amygdala is part, and that's involved in emotional response. And then the outer layer and the whole front third of your brain is called the frontal lobes. So when you talk about paranormal abilities and extrasensory perception, it's believed that those are mostly a result of using the more advanced part of your brain, the frontal lobes. And paranormal abilities and extrasensory perception are really extensions of your normal senses. So the amygdala, in fact, just lets you know that you're using those advanced parts of your brain by giving you reward. But I'd say ESP and paranormal is really computed in the frontal lobes, and this is what brain researcher TV Lingo believed for the longest time.
Neil, you were mentioning Denver. Anything going on up that way for you?
Not really. I mean, we've just really been enjoying the end of summer, and as we're getting into fall, things are really beautiful up here, and the weather as you go up into the mountains is wonderful, and we like to get away once in a while, and we'll probably head up to the mountains again on Saturday and do some more getaway and resetting of the brain, that kind of thing.
I get up there every month to tape our Beyond Belief shows, and it's just
gorgeous.
That's
right. That's right. You do come to Colorado, and we did a couple shows in Boulder, of course.
Beautiful area, really.
Yeah. You know, you've got a photo. If people go to my website, they can see one of the areas that I like to go hang out and reset the brain. If they just go to my website, brainradar.com, I put up a special link that says Coast to Coast Photos. And they can see a couple of things that we'll be talking about tonight. But there's a panoramic photo of a portion of what is the highest paid road in the world, which is the Mount Evans Highway. And I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that photo or not yet,
sure,
but it's a really great panorama of this this area that's at about 13,000 feet in elevation.
What is it about the brain, Neil, that allows people to do incredible things?
Well, the brain is, as far as we know, the most complex thing that we know of in the universe. There's between 100 billion and 200 billion neurons in the brain. Those are nerve cells. And each one of those neurons has an average of about 10,000 connections with other neurons. And if you add up all the different ways that the brain can be wired and be connected, you end up with a number that is pretty much incalculable. It's a number that would, I mean, you could say that you have as many possible connections in the human brain as there are individual grains of sand on the planet.
Wow.
And it's just such a powerful device that everyone is walking around with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You've got the most complex computer sitting right between your shoulders, on top of your shoulders. One scientist said that if you were to make a computer that would be as capable as the human brain, it would be the size of the state of Texas and a mile high. So, you know, looking at what the human brain is possible of, just in terms of sheer connections, it's staggering, and that's what allows it to do not only our normal activities, but all these fantastic abilities that we call paranormal and extrasensory. And it also is what allows people, geniuses like Einstein and Mozart and Bach, to come around and deliver such wonderful treasures that we can enjoy.
Does the ability to use your brain give you the abilities to do remote viewing and other things like that through, like, consciousness?
Well, of course it does. And, you know, it's been studied in great depth by a lot of people. I mean, there are claims that there's no proof of extrasensory perception and remote viewing, but that's absolute nonsense. There are thousands of experiments that have shown this kind of thing is possible. Beyond that, it's been my own personal experience that we've witnessed in our family and in my own life, these kinds of things that happen routinely over and over again. The latest incident that happened to you, I'd like to tell you the story of that and the picture that's online that kind of shows what that's all about. One thing that has happened in the past is we used to have a broom that would periodically fly off the wall, and we didn't know what that was all about.
A broom?
Oh, it was a decorative broom, you know, years ago when
Without a witch on it, right?
Excuse me?
Without a witch on it, right?
Well, here's the story of that particular broom. When the last Harry Potter book came out, a woodshop teacher at the local high school that I lived down the street from decided to make some decorative brooms and some decorative wands, you know, just in celebration of the Harry Potter thing. And at that point in time, and this was, I guess, around 2007, I started working on my own book about real magic and brain magic. So I went to the bookstore where these brooms were on display, and I bought them. Just kind of as an inspiration to get me, you know, going writing my own book. And I hung the brooms up on the wall. And I hung them up on these sturdy rubber hooks, and they were wedged in there very tightly so that, you know, they wouldn't come off the wall. You wouldn't knock them off the wall. Well, one night at about 1 or 2 a.m., my wife are falling asleep, and we're in bed. And all of a sudden, we hear this tremendous bang, and I just sat up in bed instantly thinking somebody was trying to break into the house, and I went to the back door, and I saw the back door was not ajar, and went to the front door, and everything seemed like it was fine, so I didn't know what it was, and I went back to sleep. But the next morning, I got up, and I went to the living room, and the broom was sitting in the middle of the living room floor. And we had no idea how it got there, but that must have been the noise that we heard. Somehow the broom had moved from the hook on the wall to the middle of the floor. And we didn't have any explanation. We just kind of ignored it. Well, it kept happening over and over again periodically. One time I was asleep in the living room with the lights turned out, and I heard a bang, and I thought I had knocked the computer off the coffee table. And again, I got up the next morning, I found the broom in the middle of the living room again. Now, the dogs are, I've got these two little Westie dogs. They're not very big. They're incapable of even reaching the bottom of the broom.
Right.
You know,
even if they got on each other's backs, they couldn't do it, right?
They couldn't do it. There was no explanation. It happened 7 more times. And finally, the 8th time, my wife and I were in the living room watching television, and we saw the broom come off the hook by itself right in front of our eyes. And after the 8th time, the broom finally fell apart, and I ended up tossing it in the trash.
And what's your explanation for it?
Well, we don't really have an explanation for it, except that there was a woman who had died in the apartment before I had moved in, which my landlord, by the way, didn't tell me about.
Uh-huh.
I found that out from someone else. So we don't know exactly what it was. But it was some sort of energy, either our own brain energy or the ghost, or we don't have an explanation for it. Now, recently I did read a book called Future Memory by an author by the name of P.M.H. Atwater.
Oh, sure.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what she says is that paranormal perception or things like that seem to be tied directly with highly emotionally charged events. Maybe it had to do with the woman who had committed suicide in the apartment before we had moved in, and that energy was left over. But in any case, she says that the limbic system, which is the area of computing emotion in the brain and the seat of the amygdala, when it receives a significant charge, commonly from a traumatic event, deals with it either by shutting down the brain completely or conversely accelerates and intensifies the brain's response to the problem to fix the problem. So it's not unlike a deer freezing in the glare of a sudden oncoming headlights, or conversely running with supercharged adrenaline from a predator. Okay, so this is how it fits into the latest paranormal experience that we had just recently in the past couple weeks. Now, let me start out by saying that, first of all, that I had lost a pair of my glasses, which I need for driving at night, and which I'd looked in vain for a couple of weeks. I looked everywhere, and I couldn't find them. I just decided not to worry about them.
Always get a backup pair, Neil.
Well, I do have a backup pair. I do have a backup pair as well, so I didn't really worry about it. But anyway, I need to preface the story with that particular thing.
Okay.
That I was missing a pair of glasses. Anyway, a couple Fridays ago, my son and I, we decided to reset our brains by driving up that mountain road that I was talking about, and the picture is on the website, the highest paved mountain road in the world. And it's a very narrow and twisty mountain road which goes from the base of Mount Evans at 11,000 feet all the way up to the summit at 14,200 feet or so. So it's important, if you look at the picture of that particular mountain road, you can see that the road drops about 1,000 feet down on one side, all right? So anyway, so my son and I, we hiked up to a very remote portion off of that road. We parked the car on the edge of the highway, and we spent the day hiking around, and we went to what I call a power spot, which I've always found opens up my brain to a completely new perspective on things. And so for all intents and purposes, we did reset our brain that day. So we finished up our hike just as the sun was setting, and we got ready to drive the 60 miles back home, when suddenly I realized I forgot to bring my regular driving glasses. I used my sunglasses to get up there, but I didn't have my driving glasses to drive home in the dark. Now, my son drives, but the car we took was this little teeny tiny Lotus Elan convertible, and he had never driven that car before, and he refused to drive us back. So so I was kind of stuck with the chore of driving back home without my driving glasses.
Without your driving glasses. Was it for glare or for seeing?
And it was hair-raising. It was, you know, praying the 60 miles back from Mount Evans to Denver, and we finally made it, you know. We prayed for an hour with our amygdalas clicked as forward as we could manage until we finally made it back to our block.
Did you, Neil, need...
Because it was just hair-raising trying to drive back without my glasses, but I had no choice. Okay.
Did you need the glasses to see or for glare?
To see clearly, driving at
night.
Wow.
Okay.
Yes. Otherwise, things are rather blurry. I'm nearsighted, and during the daytime, I can get around without my glasses, and I do my computer work and my reading and all that. But driving, at night especially, I need to wear the glasses. They give me additional power that I need to see safely.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So anyway, so I would have just dismissed that as another highly charged emotional event, except finally the next day I found my missing glasses, exactly what I should have had with me on that night drive. And I found them in the most inexplicable location, which you can see in the photo. And they were hanging on a piece of wire that was sticking out from a wind chime in my backyard.
That's what I was looking at.
Do you see my glasses there?
Yep, floating around.
There is absolutely no explanation of how the glasses got up there. I didn't put them up there and forgot. A friend, we haven't had any friends in the backyard who would have done that as a joke, and I actually called one that I thought might have done it, and he denied having to do anything with that.
You got a spirit in that house.
All I can say is the same kind of energy that was moving the broom off the wall had taken my glasses, something that I needed on that night, and stuck them up in the wind chime where I saw them.
Hold on, Neil. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the brain right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Neil Slade. Now, the photos that Neil sent us, including his dangling glasses that somehow disappeared, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com at our carousel reel first slot, so you'll be able to see them there. Neil, what part of the brain or what determines one's personality? We have nice people, bad people, funny people, clever people. Where does that originate from?
Well, it originates in a lot of different parts of the brain, of course. one of the things that comes to mind to me is the premedial prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, your brain is divided into two halves, a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere. And there's a split right down the middle. Now, on the inside front of that split is an area called the premedial frontal lobes. And what they do find is there are differences in personality types that's reflected in whether or not that area is more active or not. When they look at prison populations, specifically violent criminals, they'll find that people that have no empathy, that can't put themselves in the shoes of others, that have no regret for violent actions or crimes, they have a damage to that particular area of the brain, or that area of the brain may be very inactive, where in other people that will be normal. The frontal lobes, that whole front third of the brain, you know, if you take your hand and grasp your forehead, everything under your fingers is called the frontal lobes. And that's what scientists say controls the executive actions. It's that part of your brain that allows you to think about the consequences of your actions and how you relate to people. Now, teenagers are still developing their frontal lobes, and your frontal lobes aren't really fully developed until you get to about age 21 or 22.
You mean biologically?
Biologically, right.
All right.
You're still developing that part of your brain. So if you look at the kind of behavior the teenagers might exhibit, which might be carelessness or not thinking about the consequences of their actions, part of that has to do not only with their upbringing, but because that part of the brain is not yet fully developed yet. So when you talk about how you relate to other people, if you're a person is nice to other people, is considerate, a lot of that has to do with whether or not this frontal lobes area of your brain is active or not.
Interesting. Now, how do you activate it?
Well, that's what my work has been about for the past 30 years.
Sure has.
Is teaching people how to get more increased frontal lobes activity to happen. And that's where the phrase tickle your amygdala or clicking your amygdala comes from. And there's almost endless ways to tickle your amygdala and cause increased activity in the frontal lobes. You can use, a very quick summary. You can do meditation. You can use music. You can use art. Physical exercise will often allow the frontal lobes to become more active. You can actually use your imagination. Something as simple as imagining that you've got a feather inside your skull and you tickle, tickle, tickle those little buttons on either side of your head, and you just laugh. Now, that's very interesting because humor is computed in the frontal lobes. So your sense of humor, to activate your sense of humor and to enjoy comedy, that will also activate your frontal lobes. So there's a whole long list of things that you can do to get your frontal lobes active and have increased activity in that part of your brain. The main thing to remember is that your amygdala is an emotional feedback system. Nature is very smart. It wants you to use the most advanced parts of your brain because it's better for your survival. If you use more of your brain power, if you use your brain more efficiently, then your chances of survival are greatly enhanced. So the way that Mother Nature encourages you to use more brain is by giving you positive emotional feedback. That's one way to tell if you're using your frontal lobes or not. Long-term pleasure and positive emotion. Contrary to that, if you feel boredom or negative emotions, it means that your frontal lobes are not as active as they should be and that you're stuck into old reptilian brain ways of thinking.
Let me ask you a little bit about laughter. When you look at people who laugh, Neil, that's funnier than whatever caused them to laugh. When you think of the way the human body reacts to certain things, what is laughter and where is that generated?
Well, the brain processes humor in several areas, but the frontal lobes are initially engaged because they anticipate a joke's resolution, only to be fooled by a surprising punchline. So when that happens, the frontal lobes jump into action, and if they find something potentially funny, they'll let the effects of that humor proceed, and they send out an electrical wave through the cerebral cortex, which is the outside layer of the brain. And from there, the rest of the body responds with surprise, delight, and laughter, and the results can be anything from a mild chuckle to an all-out belly laugh. And, that chuckle does more for you than you might realize. One study at Harvard Medical School showed that laughter and humor, among other things, are powerful in combating mood disorders. Laughter can trigger the brain's emotional reward center, like the amygdala. It can deliver doses of feel-good chemicals, such as dopamine and mood-lifting serotonins. And it can increase the release of endorphins, the pain-relieving chemicals our brain releases in response to such things as exercise, food, and sex. Now, one thing that comes to mind that humor and its pain reduction ability, one thing that comes to mind is a fellow by the name of Norman Cousins, who wrote the groundbreaking book, Anatomy of an Illness. Do you recall that?
I remember the book. I don't remember the guy's name.
Well, Norman Cousins had an intractable disease, an incurable illness, and he had something like a 1 in 500 chance of recovering. And he developed his own recovery program by taking massive doses of vitamin C, but he also spent his time watching Candid Camera and watching Laurel and Hardy films.
Funny stuff.
And funny stuff. He made himself laugh. And as it turned out, he recovered from this incurable disease, and he lived to the ripe old age of 75. So humor plays a very important part in how we deal with stress.
Well, I had a story last night, Neil, where optimistic people live 15% longer than people who aren't.
Oh, yes. I've heard exactly that same thing. Exactly that same thing. Robert Anton Wilson is a famous author of science fiction, and he says he's an eternal optimist, and that the reason he says is that optimists are the ones that get things done, and pessimists are the ones who don't get things done. So he said, I might as well be optimistic because I've got nothing to lose and everything to gain.
Now, what is frontal lobe epilepsy, and how does that affect any of this?
Well, I'm not sure about frontal lobe epilepsy. Epilepsy, of course, is a discharge of energy in the brain, which upsets the normal functioning of the brain. And there have been many ways to deal with this over the years. One way that's been somewhat successful is what's called a radical hemispherectomy. And this, if this is done early enough in life, it is a cure for that. And what they do is they remove fully one half of the cortex, which is the outer layer of the brain. And by doing that, it eliminates this epileptic communication between the hemispheres, which are not synchronized.
Now, you have said that pets play a part in people's brain function as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. One thing has been consistent when they look at how pets relate to people. By the way, I've got a little model of my Westie dog sitting on my table right now that looks at me whenever I work on my computer. When humans and pet dogs interact, this causes an increase in what's called oxytocin, which is the love hormone. And it's also triggered by hugging, sex, and feeding babies, lactation. Oxytocin helps the brain modulate social concepts such as empathy, trust, and it lets you know when you should take comfort in others. So when people interact with their pets, when pets are used in pet therapy, it causes an increase of this oxytocin. I'm looking at the figures here. It says dog owners experience an average of oxytocin boost of 6% after just merely scratching and petting their canine companions. And it also causes a decrease in the levels of cortisol. And if you know what cortisol is, that's a chemical that helps, that's released when you're under a lot of stress. So if you have a lot of cortisol, that's not good for you. And pet therapy and petting your dogs, that reduces the amount of cortisol that's in your system. And as it turns out, they've measured the oxytocin level of dogs, and they in turn also show an increase of oxytocin when they're being pet and scratched by their owners as well. There's a lot of research that shows that pet therapy has a lot of impact on relieving depression.
Well, you know, airlines are allowing dogs on special handling dogs for people who are uptight about flying.
Oh, I haven't heard that. That's very interesting. So they're coming to grips with the research.
Yep, they really are. What about music? How does music play a role with the brain?
Well, that's kind of my specialty.
I've been a
professional musician my entire life. And
what's your specialty?
Well, excuse me?
What's your specialty?
Well, I play piano. I play guitar.
Good for you.
I play woodwind instruments as well.
Oh, you do it all.
I've been a jack of all trades when it comes to music, but mostly guitar and piano have been my my areas of greatest concentration. The newest album that I've released called The Book of Magic has me playing guitar on that. So I guess I would say I'm as much a guitar player as anything.
But music does have a huge role to play, I think, in people's productivity and everything else.
Oh, absolutely. They found that music is one of the activities that actually engages all parts of the brain. When you look at certain activities, you know, like physical exercise or reading or, you know, other kinds of things, they don't really engage the full capacity of the brain that music does. And educators have been putting this to really good use lately. There's one project that I just heard about that is called the Harmony Project. And it's involved in providing music lessons and instrument learning specifically to underprivileged kids who normally wouldn't have the resources to take up the instrument. And it's been found that a profound effect on kids who are otherwise drawn into things like delinquency and gangs. And research has repeatedly shown that kids who engage in music think more creatively and critically, and they perform better in school, and they're more likely to attend college. So it's not just classical music either. It's different kinds of music have different kinds of effect on the brain as well.
Well, some expert marketers, Neil, have realized that certain things trigger certain things in the brain.
Yeah.
So some restaurants, for example, you'll see red tablecloths and things like that. It makes you eat more. And in some retail stores, don't they play certain kinds of music to get you to shop more?
I don't know the specifics of that, but I would imagine that's true. You know, certain types of music will be exciting to you. Other types of music would be more relaxing. I would expect, and what I've seen in stores, if you go into a store that's selling, you know, like a store like The Gap that's more youth-oriented, mm-hmm. they're going to play music that they would expect that the shoppers would relate to, and it would make them happy as well. If you were to go into a...
You're not going to hear Frank Sinatra at The Gap, right?
Not at The Gap. You might hear Frank Sinatra in a place that's selling... support hose.
Or something.
I think it's probably marketed very specifically at the audience and who's shopping for what.
Well, does different kinds of music make you react to different things?
Oh, I'd say absolutely. I mean, there's one common question is, you know, what kind of music is best to listen to? And each type of music is going to have a different kind of effect. And I think probably your common sense would guide you. If you want to be energized, for example, you're going to listen to fast-paced music, probably music that's louder.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be relaxed, it wouldn't make any sense to listen to Led Zeppelin, right, or rap music. But if you want to be energized, that would be exactly the kind of music that you would want to listen to. So I think you can use your own common sense and intuition as to, you know, the effect of a specific type of music and how that's going to affect your performance and your brain.
Isn't there a science behind it?
There's some science behind it. One of the things that I think of is the concept of super learning, which we've talked about before. But super learning is something that came out of research in Romania during the 70s. And what was found was that listening to a classical music that went specifically at 60 beats per minute allowed for increased absorption of material. And this was then applied to learning languages and applied to learning math. And they found that if someone paced their learning along to this beat, it would greatly enhance their ability to learn.
Neil, when we come back, let's take phone calls as we talk about the brain. Neil Slade with us on Coast to Coast AM.